book is by a husband and wife, the most glamorous husband and wife in public life since Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Anne McMillan was born in Wales, the great-granddaughter of David Lloyd George, and grew up in Canada, and became a leading broadcaster and worked for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, where she was their managing editor in London. Her husband, Peter Snow, is famous for those enormous arms she still possesses, operating the great swingometer in elections for the ITN in the 60s and 70s, and was on Newsnight from its first show in 1980 till 1997. You might say the golden age of Newsnight. Together, they have written war stories, gripping tales of courage, cunning, and compassion, and treasures of world history, the story of civilization in 50 documents. And their new book is Kings and Queens, The Real Lives of the English Monarchs.
Great. Thank you very much, Harry. The book I managed to survive, by the way, apparently, outside, so it's great we've got some books to show you. We had great fun, Anne and I, writing this book, really terrific. We're both storytellers, as much as historians. And the stories, need I say, about the royal family, well, very entertaining, right the way back to the beginning of our book, Alfred the Great, right the way on, of course, to our current stories, which are absolutely innumerable about, goodness knows, all the royal family at the present. So it has been enormous fun. And it has been an extraordinary experience. We've had this royal family now at a moment of very important transition. We've had this wonderful reign of Elizabeth II, turning into the reign of Charles III. So what a time to write a book about the royal family and look back at its past. It is really very bizarre, you may think, for a democracy as sophisticated and old as ours to have decided to stick with hereditary monarchy. It's extraordinary when you think of it. And it has come up with some extraordinary ups and downs. But somehow it survived, and somehow we think, it works. And when you look at the current royal family, you think, heavens above, there's some rather curious characters around. Some of the friends they have are rather questionable. You can't help thinking that it's worth looking at the past to see if there are any lessons we can learn from what they got up to in the past. We really have to look at them to see that, although it's a very random collection of people, the Plantagenets, for example, went up and down from Henry III, Edward I, great chap, Edward II, ridiculous, Edward III, great chap. The random way in which they succeed each other is absurd, but nevertheless, somehow, it has sort of survived and somehow succeeds. It provides a sort of mantle of stability and continuity under which all the turmoil of politics can take place. I think if you see it in that light, you see them as figureheads, the royal family, however well behaved or badly behaved they are, under which the turmoil and the sort of the total chaos of politics can go on. And one thing that's very noticeable, I think, about the current situation is that the transition from Elizabeth to Charles was a very serene and smooth moment in the royal family's succession, unlike the incredible mess of the rollover of politicians we've seen as the prime ministers. So a lot of things have got a lot to say for itself. Just looking back at some of the lessons from the past and reminding us about how they compare with the current naughty boys and girls of the present administration or family, you've only got to go back. I'm just making some examples. If you go back to a wonderful chap, I think, called Edwig. A chap called Edwig, King Edwig, 950 roughly, AD. And he was, you know, Prince Andrew, all these other chaps, nothing to Edwig. Edwig was wonderful. On his coronation day, he was invited, obviously, to a banquet, where he was supposed to make a speech or two, and behave himself and present himself. But he didn't turn up. And so, the wonderful abbot of Glastonbury, a great chap called Dunstan, a very impressive man, who, great patriarch, became Archbishop of Canterbury later. Dunstan was sent off to find Edwig and bring him to the banquet. So Dunstan went and asked the servant where Edwig was, and the servant said, "He's in bed." Dunstan went down to the king's bedroom, and there in bed was Edwig having a threesome with a young cousin and her mother. Dunstan had to drag the king, literally drag him into the jar, that's what it was, really, Thank you all for the banquet. And then Henry the First, after all, a wonderful king in many ways, had 22 illegitimate children. A wonderful king, very impressive king, but he had no problem with morals or whatever. Take all these other chaps. I mean, I'm just cutting more examples here of all these people. Edward VIII's grandfather, Edward VII, had innumerable mistresses, including, for example, Alice Capel, his favourite, Alice Capel, who was the great-great-grandmother of our wonderful queen today, Queen Camilla. And Alice Capel, not like Camilla, shared a great sense of humour with her great-granddaughter, great-great-granddaughter, and also had a rather throaty voice. I'm not, that's not nice. So there we are. And then George IV, after all. Can't even say anything more about George IV. I mean, he's supposed to have had a meal of 10 courses and 128 different things on the plate at the same time. I mean, it's a ridiculous debauchee. And yet here we are saying, oh, dear me, the royal family, the members are dreadful lads. They really are compared with some of the people in history. One thing we came up with, an obvious thing to do, is to come up with the sort of people who made their indelible mark on history. What sort of folks and girls have made an indelible mark on history? I mean, you all have your own views, I'm sure. But we came up with a small list, just thought I'd just try you on for fun. We start with Alfred, and he was the first man in our book. He's the first chapter in our book, Alfred the Great. Alfred was a phenomenon. And even today, Alfred was still, I think, looked like the greatest monarch we've had. He's an extraordinary man. If you've read about Alfred, you'll agree with me. I mean, he was extremely learned. He couldn't read when he was a kid. He learned to read when he grew up. He was a wonderful man. He designed, really, the system of local government we have at the moment. The boroughs that we have now were invented by Alfred the Great. The system of local government was his. The way in which we started recognizing law and order and education as essential parts of anybody's cultural education were invented by Alfred in many ways. He was the first person to talk about the Anglo-Saxon country as England, and the language we spoke as English. And of course he kept the Danes, as mineral chaps, at bay. They were a pain in the neck, the Danes. They kept raiding and grabbing things. And so Alfred knew how to deal with them. He actually made the Danish leader his godson. And that sorted things out for a while. We gave him Alfred, who was, I think, really, maybe was the greatest king we've had. We gave him his way. He's called the Great, after all. Not just by the Victorians, but by people later, by people like you and me. Athelstan. Now, Athelstan apparently was recognized as the number one by several people in a sort of vote we had the other day. I think Dan's involved in that. Our son Dan, my wife Anne and I have a great son called Dan, who's a great historian. And he organized a sort of vote that came up with Athelstan. Athelstan, Alfred's grandson, united the country for the first time, felt he was able on his coins to call himself Rex Toti Britannia, the king of the whole of Britain. He got Northumbria online, he got Mr. East Anglia, and he also got Wessex and Mercia, of course, which were his already. But he was a great chap, and he was a wonderful warrior, and again, he beat the Danes with a battle, extraordinary battle, we don't know where it was, Battle of Brunanburh, extraordinary place. Well, then we go on to our next choice, Henry II, Henry II, Henry, the House of Anjou. Henry II was a terrific chap. You may remember Becket was murdered under his rule, but he was quite right not to murder Becket. He was quite right to have a row with Becket, because the church was far too wealthy, disgracefully wealthy in the 12th century. Henry VIII thought so too in the 16th century. But because Henry failed, because Becket, and he failed to agree, because Becket, when he went from his chancellorship to the Archbishop of Canterbury, became wedded to the church and its wealth and its power and its influence. Henry did nothing about it. But he was right to go to the church and sadly failed. He was a great warrior and he was a great chap too, not making. He the wife of the King of France, Louis VII, Eleanor of Aquitaine, and he married her. And great thing to do because she couldn't have any children with Louis for some reason, so he annulled the marriage, Louis, and off she went with Henry II. Great, great idea. And she brought with her, of course, a huge chunk of France. It's quite nice. So Henry had ended up, or began his dream really very soon, with the empire that spread from the Scottish border to the Pyrenees. So he was a great chap. We think he was really a great chap. Then he brought Henry VII. I could choose Henry VII. I think both of us agree about this, don't we? Henry VII was the man who united the two roses, ended the Wars of the Roses. He was very sensible about the people he advised and who advised him. England under Henry VII, first of the Tudors, was a very prosperous country, as it had been under the Anglo-Saxons, by the way. No question, Anglo-Saxon England was a sensational place. And then Henry VII went on to deliver us with Henry VIII. You can't miss him out. I'm not talking about the good and bad kings, I'm talking about the ones who make an indelible mark on history. Henry VIII, no question. You can't avoid him. Six wives or none. I mean, he was a terrific chap. And he sorted out the church problem that Henry II had failed to sort out. He built up the navy, and of course he destroyed the monasteries and all that stuff, which was in a way a bad thing. It was a great source of education and local wealth and so on. But they really had much too much power and influence. And so he did away with all that. And he left, although he started so brilliantly and ended up such a tyrant, never mind, he did great things for this country. Elizabeth, his daughter, went well to avoid her. She was terrific. Not probably as wonderful a queen as her descendant, Elizabeth II. But Elizabeth I, you can't avoid. And so you go on, and you go through the longer reigns later on of George III, Victoria, and Elizabeth. And although they didn't innovate and themselves create change so much as the people, the prime ministers and the others in the country, the cultural chiefs and so on, nevertheless, they provided this aura of unity under which all this stuff could innovate and develop. So those reigns are very important, as I'm sure we all know. The various things we sort of came up with as a result of our book, we did over 64 monarchs from Alfred to Charles III, and we've come up with several thoughts. So the succession, how they managed the succession. I mean, it was a total shambles through early medieval period. William I, you know, Normandy the Conqueror, left England to his son, his second son, William II, William Rufus. His first son was furious. Robert Duke of Normandy was the eldest son of William. Couldn't accept this. And he spent his life, 10 years, attacking William Rufus for having England. He thought, it's not acceptable. I should have had it. So poor old William, the succession was a total failure there, almost scarcely that William II remained king. But Robert was a pain in the neck. And so it goes on through the right the way through the early medieval period, Henry VI, all the dreadful fights, and Richard III, and so on and so forth, until you get to the Tudors, when succession becomes an obsession. Henry VIII was obsessed by the problem of who's to succeed him. He was determined it should be his son, Edward VI, and not his daughters. And then he changed his mind and made the daughters again. And then it's made sure that Edward accepted his daughters, the daughters of Mary and Elizabeth, would succeed Edward. Complete chaos. Edward, of course, then made the mistake of not going for his sisters, half-sisters, but going for Lady Jane Grey. Tragic, pitiable woman who had only 9 days on the throne. And then you go on through the others, and the succession gets to Queen Anne. And Queen Anne had no children. Her children, all the children died. 11 of them? 17 of these kids died before she became queen. So no succession. Infuriating. Same with Elizabeth, same with Mary, same with Edward VI. Queen Anne. Good old Queen Anne. She was told by Parliament, look, the answer is to find the Protestants, if you say, you've got to hear these Catholics invading the country again, get out of the Protestants. And they said they dug around to find a cousin in Hanover called George. And this guy couldn't speak a word of English, became King George I. From then onwards, the succession has been uncontested. Absolute straight succession, no mucky about it. But the question that we've been posed since then has been the suitability of the successor. And I mean, we're going to say a lot about that, but I won't. Simply to say the succession we have at the moment, Charles, seems to me, and I've had to chat with Andrew about this, I mean, and Lucy, Charles, I am very optimistic about Charles, not about you, but I think it's terrific. I think he's made a great start. And I think people say that Charles, who said before he became king, it would be stupid to involve myself in the kind of opinionating that I did beforehand. I won't take words out of all your mouths, but my impression is that it actually would be rather good for Charles to go on with a bit of his campaign, maybe at a slightly lower pitch. But you know, he's campaigning for against global warming. All his talk about architecture, and so I didn't see it much for Prince's Trust. He's a guy who can go out there and say what he thinks. I think that's one of the provocative things to say, you'll be shaking your heads. But we think Charles is a good thing, Anne and I. We think he's, on the whole, the jury is out, of course. The jury's out. But the future jury, the one that matters in about 2 years' time, we think it'll come up with a verdict of very much not guilty, a good man. And then finally, just very quickly, am I allowed to say this?
Yes.
We've just looked at the great issue of the declining power of the monarchs. This, of course, is a fascinating subject. And I mean, each of the kings and queens we look at how they related to, obviously, Parliament, which for the time of William III was accepted by that brilliant monarch. He was a great chap, Charles. William Orange. But until then, it was the ups and downs were extraordinary. You had John forced to sign the Magna Carta, the rule of our democracy. You had all these other chaps who contested the power of Parliament. Edward I and Edward III, the two good Edwards, were excellent about it. The Tudors are very sensible. William III came along and changed things. But then we got to start before him. We got James I, wonderful chap, James I, who said very famously, he said, I couldn't imagine one of my ancestors could have thought up this extraordinary institution of Parliament. And then one of his great mates in Parliament, a chap with the glorious name of Sir Julius Caesar. Sir Julius Caesar, no, it's sort of like, let's say it's not. But Julius Caesar said it very good. But Julius Caesar said famously that the Parliament was the enemy of democracy, which is extraordinary, really. He's an incredible chap. And so good old James dissolved Parliament for 12 of his 13 years in power. And it's amazing how he did it. I'm not going to shut up. So you had this incredible up and down of the declining power of the monarchs. And then you finally get the situation that we had under Victoria, all the Badgers saying they just have the right to warn and encourage, and to be consulted. And that works out very well. And so we've got a monarchy now, with a constitutional monarchy, that really we reckon, at the end of it all, is pretty good success. And we're looking at William V coming up, and little George, it all looks very promising. I'll shut up, I think very much indeed.